recent legislation passed in California, SB 54, which prevents law enforcement from communicating directly with ICE on certain issues. And it causes us concern. It's going back to a pre-9/11 condition where public agencies aren't communicating with each other. Now we're legislating that we cannot communicate with each other, and it makes the community less safe.
Orange County Undersheriff Don Barnes explaining his agency's decision to make public the release dates for all inmates in OC jails, including inmates who are undocumented. It's a workaround of sorts to SB 54, the California law that limits local law enforcement's ability to share information with the feds. Advocates for immigrants and their communities are upset with the move, fearing it will keep residents from engaging with the police. It's a concern Orange County Undersheriff Don Barnes is familiar with, but not one he agrees with.
This is a legal action that we can take. This is information that can be made publicly available. We're not narrowing the information down to any certain or person within our jail, and we don't identify it directly to immigration status. Every person within our jail is listed on the Who's in Jail site. They always have been. We're simply adding an additional field that now lets people know the date and time in which they're scheduled for release.
And speaking to what you were just bringing up, cooperating with federal immigration, what do you get from cooperation and from that relationship? What's the benefit?
Well, the benefit is to the community. Anytime that we have anything prohibiting law enforcement from turning over, holding criminals accountable, it makes the community less safe. That's been our argument from the beginning. The sheriff and I both were against this legislation because it has irreparable harms to the community, and we've been sharing that message since last year. Some of the language in SB 54 was removed, but it still prohibits us from communicating directly with immigration on those who are in our custody. Some provisions remained, and the sheriff has the discretion to notify ICE on those high-level offenders under the Trust Act. These would be people, for example, convicted of very serious offenses, violent crimes, drug trafficking, human trafficking. And to date, as of March 19th, we had notified Immigration, Customs Enforcement of 168 inmates who rose to that very high level and could be turned over to immigration. Unfortunately, 172 inmates didn't rise to that high level who are criminals and were released into the community, and oftentimes back into the communities in which they prey upon in the first place. And that makes those communities less safe.
Well, you're speaking to safety, though. How do you respond to the concerns in neighborhoods and among law enforcement, some law enforcement, that this could, among other things, further erode policing in many neighborhoods and hurt public safety because fewer people will be willing to come forward and talk about what's going on?
Actually, I think it does exactly the opposite. We have good relationships with the communities in which we serve. This actually prevents these individuals from returning to those communities and hopefully prohibits ICE from having to go look for them within the communities they return to. So if we have the ability to turn somebody over to customs and to ICE agents directly, it makes the community safer. These individuals that are then prevented from going back to the community, potentially arming themselves, and quite honestly, immigration is going to go looking for them. And not speaking for ICE, but it does present what I consider to be a harm to the community when they go out looking for these criminals and potentially finding other people who have not committed criminal acts that are egregious. You know, they're not criminals. They're just here and maybe undocumented, and subjects them to being located as well, which has never been the intent, our intent, in serving the communities that we police. We do not do police functions for immigration at the local street level. We never have. We cannot do that under federal law. But our intent is to hold criminals accountable and use every tool available to us wherever possible to prevent them from returning to the community.
But that is the concern of many critics, including Annie Lai, co-director of the Immigrant Rights Clinic at UC Irvine. She said this new policy is part of a movement in Orange County to either undermine or get around the spirit of SB 54, and that the change in policy is basically affecting everybody else who doesn't have a serious criminal history under SB 54 or is a nonviolent offender.
Barbara, that's actually a false narrative that the sheriff and I have been warning against with our community. The Sheriff's Department does not go into the community, nor does any police agency in Orange County, and do immigration-level enforcement. We provide public protection to every resident in Orange County, regardless of immigration status. But when this false narrative is being delivered through the community, it prevents them and makes them fearful of calling for help, of reporting crime, or being witnesses in crime, which makes those communities less safe. We want to create an environment in which we use these tools or make these tools and information available that prevents criminals from returning to the communities in which they prey upon, so we can build relationships with them, not barriers in working with them.
Well, this takes place in a larger backdrop of a push now in parts of Orange County to push back against California's efforts to stymie federal action on immigration. And what do you make of that? Are you supportive?
I was supportive of the U.S. Attorney General's lawsuit?
Yes.
Yes, I'm supportive of that because it will prevent or hopefully return us to a position and an environment where we can cooperate with any law enforcement agency. We do not want to go back to a time where we cannot talk laterally between federal agencies and law enforcement agencies. That's the pre-9/11 condition that led to one of the greatest catastrophes in U.S. history, because agencies were not talking, and now we're legislating that agencies do not talk with one another. And some of these individuals are pretty significant criminals with significant criminal history. We should not allow them nor back into our community. We should use every tool available to hold them accountable. And when necessary, if ICE deems necessary, they have the ability to locate them using our website and start deportation proceedings if necessary. That's their determination to make, not ours. We're simply making these release dates publicly available for anybody to view, which could include Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to determine when somebody's being released from our custody.
Undersheriff Don Barnes of Orange County, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Barbara.
Another story today involving immigrants in the U.S. The 2020 census will include a new question about whether or not you're a citizen. The Commerce Department has announced the change last night. It's a controversial move, and following suit, California has wasted no time suing the Trump administration, saying the change would lead to an inaccurate census count. California's Secretary of State, Alice Padilla, said
the supposed justification of adding the citizenship question back into census in order to enforce the Voting Rights Act is beyond laughable. It's contemptible, and we're going to fight it tooth and nail.
So what will the impact be, and will California's challenges be successful? Justin Levitt is professor at Loyola Law School. He's a former attorney in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, and it's great to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So this change has been rumored for quite a while. Is there any surprise at all that the Trump administration went ahead and made it?
There is, in part because cooler heads have usually prevailed at Commerce. When it comes to messing with the census, the single biggest rule is you don't change something until you test it, and test it thoroughly. That's because the census is the biggest civilian mobilization this country has. Every 10 years, we go out and collect information from every single person, and small changes can have big unintended consequences. So the Justice Department asked for this change. I think that request was nonsense, as the Secretary of State does. But I think there was real hope that the Commerce Department would evaluate it, realize we were just too close to the census to do this without thorough testing. And so yesterday's snap decision caught a lot of people off guard.
Well, lay this out for us. What's the administration's rationale?
The rationale is that there are some types of cases under the Voting Rights Act for which citizenship information is useful. The way that the Justice Department has brought these cases, and I should know I was bringing many of them, the way that the Justice Department brings these cases is using a sample for the population, and that's something that's been done consistently and without problem for a very long time. That gets at most of the concerns. The ostensible rationale is that that doesn't get at extremely small jurisdictions where you really need more precise information on citizenship. The problem with that is that by going after this extremely small layer of precision, they're going to create enormous amounts of inaccuracy. And so it's like trying to smooth out the ocean. Whatever you do to tamp down one wave is going to get swamped by the other effects in the pool.
And just remind us, why is this important? What is the purpose of the census, and why would this have potential consequences?
The census is literally the first thing in the Constitution that the federal government is called on to do. It's the fifth and sixth sentence in. It says we're going to have a House of Representatives. They're going to be based on population, and we need a census to figure out where the population is. It has always been the case that census's mission one is to accurately count the number of people within the country. And everything else the census does, and they do a lot of other stuff, is carefully calibrated, or at least has been, to not mess with the first mission. The concern is that by asking a question about citizenship to the entire population, in this climate in particular, where people are afraid, and sometimes have reason to be afraid, that people will not respond to the census, which is going to cause an inaccurate count. It's going to make us not know where the people are, how many we have. And that goes directly into representation. It goes directly into funding. It goes directly into a lot of how the government does business.
And that's meaning afraid to answer this question, are you a citizen or not, that there will be repercussions from that. But Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross argued that there really is no evidence proving that a citizenship question would drop the response rate.
I think that the Commerce Secretary hasn't been paying attention to what's been going on around him. Advocates who are out in the country know that people are very concerned. People are afraid. People don't trust the federal government. Even when this question has been posed in the past, in a survey environment, along with a lot of other information, there's been feedback that some people decline to answer the question. If you now go out and ask everyone, that is a major, major change. And him saying there's no hard and fast evidence that this is going to screw everything up is like dropping a nuclear bomb and then trying to figure out afterward whether there's evidence it does any damage.
Maybe you could give us a dollar figure. What are the consequences of people being undercounted?
The first consequence is in political representation. So every 10 years we have a census. That drives how many congressional seats each state has. That also drives the distribution of power within states and drives state legislative distribution of power, drives local distribution of power. So district lines for political representatives follow the census. And when the count isn't accurate, we are not represented as a people accurately. The second thing it does is it affects funding formulas, funding to both states in block grants and to areas of states. Often depend on where the people are and which people of which kinds are in which places. And if there is an undercount or if there's inaccuracy in the count, there's billions of dollars that get adjusted based on the census data.
So California immediately sued last night. How do you see this playing out? Are states poised to follow California's lead?
I think there will be other states poised to follow California's lead. I think there'll be nonprofit groups poised to follow California's lead. I think, frankly, there should be congressional representatives who are poised to follow California's lead. And I think it's a big open question about whether Congress allows this to affect the census. And by that, I don't just mean the usual suspects. Typically, people have associated minority communities and immigrant communities with more steadfast activism by the Democrats. But Republicans stand to lose an awful lot by this latest decision. If there's an undercount, that means that the areas with the fastest growing immigrant population, the fastest growing non-citizen population, won't get additional congressional seats. And right now, those are states like Texas, like Georgia, like Alabama, like Florida. States where Republican legislators would likely be in charge of drawing the lines after the next census. And so if you are a strategic politician in Congress, if you're a Republican, you desperately want there to be an accurate count of those areas because those are extra districts at your disposal. I think that a lot of people haven't done the math on how this impacts representation going forward, and that means a lot of protest by both sides of the aisle.
Justin Levitt, he's professor at Loyola Law School, and I appreciate you coming on the show today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, he was once allegedly one of the biggest peddlers of performance-enhancing drugs at the center of a global doping ring, and he's never been charged with a crime. A look inside the murky trade in banned substances. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. On paper, Michael A. Marcanis is a lawyer who lives in the suburban town of Queen Creek, Arizona. But Marcanis allegedly also goes by the name of Thomas Mann and is believed to have been at one time at the center of one of the broadest sports doping networks in U.S. history. A U.S. anti-doping agency's investigation found that he shipped packages of peptides, a building block for protein, to more than 8,000 people in just 1 year. Many of them were professional athletes. The investigation was halted last year and no criminal charges were filed. Michael Powell is a sports columnist for the New York Times. His story about this investigation ran yesterday in the Times. And Michael, it's good of you to join us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Really interesting. Who is this guy, Marcanis? And I said he's a lawyer, but does he have any scientific or medical training?
No. I mean, that's what's one of the things that's kind of fascinating about him is that he is a lawyer who appears not to have practiced law and a person who is extremely knowledgeable on chemistry, the chemistry of the body, but, you know, is not a chemist and has never practiced chemistry.
So what is his product? And I said it's peptides. What kind of performance-enhancing drug is that? What does it do? And is it illegal?
You know, yes. I mean, the answer is that without to cut to the last question, without a prescription, it is illegal, and some of these peptides are not prescribed in any case. And what they do is that they help the body do any number of things depending on the peptide itself, but it either helps the body burn fat, it helps the body create more oxygen, which it, when you think about it, if you're involved in anything from, you know, running to rowing to football or basketball is a very valuable thing. And it basically helps the body do or makes the body do things that it would not do naturally. Some of those things, arguably, are you know, not dangerous for the body, and some of those things could be quite dangerous for the body. Much of this has never been tested. I mean, it's never been approved by the FDA. It's never so there's really no way of knowing precisely how dangerous some of these things may or may not be.
And where does he get it? Does he make it or does he buy it?
Another good question. I mean, the assumption is, my assumption is, that at least in large part, he's getting it from someone else. And when you start, you know, delving into this world, Central and Southern Arizona is kind of filled with a lot of these suppliers, these labs. And so, you know, it could be quite possibly that he's getting this stuff from people, you know, kind of in-state or in that region. A number of foreign countries, China notably among them, are also big suppliers of peptides and human growth hormone, illegally, that is, and it's illegally shipped into the country and then distributed to, you know, chemists here who make and remake stuff.
And apparently illegally shipped out of this country, too. Who are this guy's clients?
You know, the clients range from a number of world-class athletes, pro athletes, that is baseball, basketball, football, Olympic athletes, track and field, wrestlers, to a lot of, you know, kind of what we would think of as weekend stars, you know, guys and women who go out and bike and run and do all these other sorts of things in a amateur way, but who cheat. And, you know, it's long been known that the kind of high amateur circuit is filled with a fair amount of cheating, unfortunately, as well as, I should say, obviously, a lot of folks who do it perfectly legally. And all of them, I mean, once you start going into the kind of the forums for this, for his site, that is for Marcanis's website, you know, you kind of see a mix of all of these.
Now, am I crazy, or have I seen the word peptides in my anti-aging cream? I feel. Is it only athletes who are buying this stuff?
No. As I say, it's not. And some peptides are legal. Some peptides have been approved. You're absolutely right. It's an anti-aging. You know, I mean, it's in various kind of skin creams and other things.
Oh, so this is where we get into this gray area. And maybe it anticipates my next question is why hasn't he been charged with anything or been caught before or come to the into the sights of authorities?
Because it is this strange gray area where most of the stuff is a misdemeanor, what he's engaged in. In other words, it's not allowed, but the penalties are misdemeanors. So from the point of view of a U.S. attorney, in fact, the one I talked to in Arizona, he says, well, you know, I could go after him or I could go after, you know, the eight guys that are bringing in fentanyl, you know, an incredibly dangerous opioid from China, and that's killing, you know, dozens and dozens and hundreds of people in my area. So I'll concentrate on those. But he did add, at least until Congress or the FDA puts more teeth into the enforcement of this stuff, that is, this stuff being peptides. And I did talk to a number of doctors, real experts at John Hopkins at Mayo, who said, look, some of this stuff could be truly dangerous. You know, he said, this is human experimentation at a pretty dangerous level. But again, there's not the kind of neither Congress nor the FDA has put the kind of teeth behind this stuff to make it worth pursuing from the point of view of law enforcement.
How did they even find him in the first place, if they're not really looking for this kind of stuff?
Yeah, well, they're not. I mean, that is law enforcement, but the United States Anti-Doping Agency, which is the, you know, charged with looking at all kinds of stuff for sports, for the Olympics, for baseball, for football. I mean, they're looking at it very hard. And when Swiss inspectors came across some packages that had been sent from this fellow in Arizona to some Swiss man and woman, they then contacted USADA, that is the anti-doping agency. They had never heard of the guy at that point, and they kind of just filed it away, and then his name came up in a documentary that had been done by Al Jazeera, and they about how these substances had gone to pro athletes, and all of a sudden they had a kind of voila moment where they decided, okay, we're going to jump on this. And they started investigating him, and that's, you know, in part the work they did, and, you know, as well as the work that we did at the New York Times kind of fleshed out who this person was.
Wild story, really interesting. Thank you so much for it, Michael.
Oh, thank you.
Michael Powell, sports columnist for the New York Times. Coming up in Italy, a fabric maker loses his family business to global trade and finds himself rethinking everything.
I've always thought that progress was important, but what happens when progress stops? In Italy, we feel that progress has stopped.
Globalization and its discontents. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. Madeline Brand is away this week. Tariffs and trade wars are now a big part of the economic conversation in this country, thanks to President Trump. And the forces of globalization that helped elect him are not just at work here, but also around the world. Before she left, Madeline spoke with a man who experienced this firsthand.
In the 1990s, Eduardo Nesi had a comfortable life. He was working in a small industrial city just outside Florence, Italy. Business boomed at his family-owned textile factory. But as Europe transitioned to the euro and China entered the World Trade Organization, orders at his factory withered. Nesi was eventually forced to sell his family business. He was out of work, just like millions of other Italians, Europeans, and Americans whose jobs moved overseas. Nesi is now an Italian politician. He's a filmmaker and an author, but he sees his story as illustrating the dark side of globalization. And he uses it to frame his latest book, which he co-wrote with an investment banker friend. It's called Everything is Broken Up in Dances: The Crushing of the Middle Class. And Eduardo Nesi joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, so you wrote this book. It's kind of like a conversation between you and your friend, Guido Brera. And he is an investment banker, correct?
Exactly.
And you're talking about this period from the 1990s to now, where in the 1990s, everyone was optimistic about globalization. NAFTA passed. Everyone thought there was a bright, shiny future in a borderless world. And you thought that too, right?
Well, yes. We were making fabrics and we were selling them to the most important stylists in the world. You name them, they were working with us.
Like Versace.
Versace, Armani, and Dolce & Gabbana, and Prada, and all these people.
And you were making the fabrics for their
clothes.
Yes,
we are making just the fabrics, because fabrics and apparel are two completely different kind of business. And but we were working in a global way. I mean, we were buying the wool in Australia, we were buying the linen in Lithuania or France, and we were just giving another quality to things. We are transforming raw fibers in the most beautiful fabrics in the world. So we were good. I mean, we were good.
You were good. And then you say that 20 days were all it took for everything to change. And this was in 2001, right?
Yes.
And China had entered the World Trade Organization.
Yes.
And the euro was adopted.
Yes. In 20 days, everything changed, because the Chinese products of a very low quality started to enter the market, and they changed completely. I mean, in a way, they corrupted the idea of what kind of fabric you have to use to have quality. Our customers were not anymore interested, and they were finding bad things, bad fabrics at not a half of a price, but almost. And you start to feel that you don't understand the world anymore, because everything that had been true for the last 20 years suddenly started to become false.
But why were these high fashion houses, the Armanis, as you say, the Versaces, why did they want to get inferior fabric? Didn't they want the good quality stuff?
This is a very good question, because at the beginning, it was not only a matter of Armani. It was a matter of the middle quality, customers of ours. They all went bankrupt because they couldn't hold the competition of Zara, of H&M, of these fast fashion companies. The other ones, I mean, just to give you an idea, why are we all dressed in black? You know, there is the idea of fashion, the idea that it makes you slim. That's why I wear it too. And then there is the fact you don't have
today,
this problem.
But usually I do.
and then there is this problem that, this fact that if you have a black fabric, you can make almost any mistake in producing it and nobody will see it. It's not as evident, Black hides everything.
And so what, they were buying black fabric from China and it was okay?
Yes. And they were buying, for example, synthetic fibers instead than wool. But I would like our economy, our fabrics, for example, to fight on the same level of the Chinese. For example, we have tariffs if you want to export to China. That was the idea. When China will grow up and then you will export fabrics to China. It's not true. I mean, it's only working for a very small percentage. And then you have to dye your own fabric with the substances that are not toxic. And they are doing it, and we cannot do it. I mean, just give us a level playing field.
Well, now you sound like President Trump. He says those words, those very same words. in fact, we've been having a conversation in this country about tariffs and protectionism and globalization. And a lot of the words in your book are words that the president himself has uttered many times.
And that's also one of the reasons why we wanted to cancel the book.
Cancel selling it?
Yes. Let's forget about the book. Because when we heard about the inaugural speech of Trump, I had a huge problem. I called Guido and said, Guido, let's forget about the book. We'll never publish it. Because how can you understand that somebody like President Trump can talk in favor of middle class? What does he know of the middle class people?
But he talks a lot about how China is unfair. Unfair to America, unfair in the world stage. And you say the same.
Well, you know, we've been beaten by China so much. I mean, Italy has been, Italian economical system, Italian economical fabric, let's say, has been beaten up by the Chinese. So we are not maybe the best one to speak in their defense. Again, we would like to be able to fight on the same terrain.
So would you agree about imposing tariffs on Chinese
no,
goods?
No, tariffs, that would not be, I mean, let me say it clear. If you put a tariff of 20% on Chinese fabric, it would not be enough.
It wouldn't be enough.
So tariffs is not a good idea. I would like them to have been obliged to follow our strict procedures to make fabrics. Let's try to ask them to dye, for example, without using toxic substances, and to respect all we have to respect in terms of pollution when we produce fabrics. And let's see what happens then.
And what if they do, and the fabric is still cheaper than it would be to be made
then,
in Italy?
Then they win, and we are happy with this.
Really?
Because no, we have already lost. We have already lost.
You lost your factory.
Yes. I had to sell it.
And this was a factory that had been in your family for how many generations?
I was a third generation.
So what happened after you sold it off? What happened to you?
Well, you lose your sense of who you are in the world. You wake up in the morning and you realize that you're not going, you don't have anywhere to go. And I started to write a few years before that time, so I had at least the chance to find something to do. Because otherwise, the only thing I had to do was bringing my son and my daughter to school and bringing them back, bringing them to soccer or to dance, and that was for a few years. Those were the only things I could do, and try to multiply this for millions
of
because
people.
Millions of people lost their jobs, and there were many of them were the best. Well, why do I say the best? Because the Italian craftsmanship is known the world over, and whole sectors of it have been swept away from the globalization. So experience, artisanal experience that were dating back to the last century were swept away. So because when you say that market, the fittest survives, well, we were very good. We were, you know, betrayed in a way by history. That's how we feel, what we feel.
Betrayed by history. But you started writing and you won Italy's highest prize, the Strega Prize.
Yes.
You became a politician. So you reinvented yourself and you're doing well, and which I guess is an argument that globalists make, which is, well, in this changing economy, people need to adapt and change their skills and, you know, do something else.
Well, yes, you know, it's funny because I won the Strega Prize telling of my disaster, my personal disaster. So I cannot rejoice that much, because all my literary success comes from the story of my failings. So you cannot be that happy, all that happy about this.
So it's bittersweet.
Yes, more bitter than sweet.
Mm-hmm. There's a part in your book where you say that we have exchanged the glittering gifts that globalization has given to our society in exchange for getting rid of our social safety nets. So rights in exchange for merchandise.
Yes. This is what we feel. I understand that in America it may be a bit more complicated to understand, because you have such a strong economy and that you have never faced this kind of situation. You had a terrible housing crisis, I mean, the real estate crisis, but after 1 year, more or less, everything was settled. We are still have to recover from that crisis.
So 10 years after the financial crisis began, Italy is still not out of it yet?
Absolutely no.
And what does that look like?
What it looks like, we have an unemployment that for young people is very near to 40%.
40?
40. Yes. Wow. In the South, it's even worse than that. In the South, there's almost no way to get a job. And when this happens, you lose your trust in the future. You start to feel that something has gone wrong somewhere.
And so given this sense of despair or hopelessness that a large portion of the country is experiencing in Italy, are they then attracted to any kind of populist leaders along the lines of a Donald Trump?
Exactly. Yes, they are. In Italy, we are about to have a government that puts together these two populists. We have the five-star movement, which is very complicated to explain out of Italy. And then we have the Northern League, which is a party that is even worse, because they are openly racist and fascist, in my opinion. So how can you have hope with this? I mean, I've always thought that progress was important. But what happens when progress stops? In Italy, we feel that progress has stopped.
And you don't see a way out for now?
No. You know, I was shocked by these elections, because you start to feel that the people are wise. You know, democracy is this, the feeling that the people can vote for their own well-being. And then suddenly this comes out, this effect comes out. And to me, I have lost trust, not in democracy, but in the way the Italians understand it. Yes, I did.
Well, I think we've heard the same thing here in this country.
I read the New York Times every day, so I know that.
The book is called Everything is Broken Up in Dances, The Crushing of the Middle Class, by Eduardo Nessi, and co-written with his friend Guido Maria Brera. Eduardo Nessi, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Coming up, Cheetos, pudding in a cup, bologna, even spongy Wonder Bread. The food that still fills so much of our supermarkets came from an unlikely and semi-secret source, Army Labs, the military industrial food complex. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Madeline Brand. From M&Ms that melt in your mouth and not in your hands to sliced bread, there's a secret military history of food in the United States. Food that never spoils on the battlefield or on your pantry shelves. Anastasia Marx de Sacedo is a food writer and author of Combat Ready Kitchen, How the U.S. Military Shapes the Way You Eat. Welcome to the show, Anastasia.
Thank you for having me, Barbara.
I love this topic. I understand the story pretty much starts with the MRE, the rations known as meals ready to eat, and that preventing spoilage was a huge scientific challenge for the military, and they really rose to it. So why don't you tell us about the Combat Feeding Directorate?
Sure. Well, the Combat Feeding Directorate is actually about 15 minutes from my house, and I didn't discover it until I got into this topic. But it is one of 80 federal laboratories for the military around the country. And there they research and develop anything to do with supporting the individual soldier, and that includes combat rations. The Combat Feeding Directorate is located in this kind of blue and teal striped building at the back of this 78-acre facility, and there they have about 300 full-time employees. Most of them are civilians, and many of them are food scientists and food technologists. And what they do 365 days a year is to research and perfect combat rations.
And this goes all the way back to at least World War II. So what kinds of food did they come up with in the beginning, and how did soldiers like it?
Yeah, you're right that it goes right back to World War II. And in fact, this whole system was developed because during World War II, the U.S. really had a crisis in being able to feed the troops, because those increased from about 400,000 to 11.6 million over the course of 4 years. And so they had the two sort of first modern combat rations. They had something called the Sea Rat, which some people may have heard of, which was basically a stew in a can. And then the D ration. The D ration was a deliberately unpalatable chocolate bar. And it was deliberately unpalatable so that people wouldn't eat it right away and would save it for an emergency. During that time, because those things really didn't work out very well, as you can imagine, the U.S. government set up this laboratory, which expanded from 3 to 300 people, from a budget of $750 to a budget that was funding over 500 projects in universities and industrial laboratories around the country, and special research areas for vitamins, for sensory evaluation, for packaging. So there's this huge increase. And out of that came a system where, to this day, the military is constantly looking into new ways to preserve food and make it more nourishing.
Well, what came out of that? And the military, it's doing all this high-level testing on making food spoilage resistant. How did this science make the jump into the civilian market?
Well, it's actually a really interesting thing. It was purposeful. And that is because after World War II ended, the government kind of looked around and said, wow, we've, you know, built this huge system to supply this enormous war. What should we do with it? And so they said, well, let's not dismantle it. Let's just keep it around. And in case there's another war of this scale, we'll be good to go. And so over time, it actually sort of institutionalized this idea of transferring anything that was researched and developed in the military to the private sector, and to get that into, you know, private companies. And so the food industry is a partner in all this.
Oh, so that's the leap to mass production. And what do we have to thank for this leap?
We have many, many things. One of my favorite is actually cheese powder, which came out of a military effort during World War II to figure out how to, you know, make cheese light and imperishable. They took out all the water. They would ship that overseas for troops. After the war, the cheese dehydration industry that came about because of this no longer had a customer, so they switched to the grocery manufacturers of America, who turned it into snack and convenience foods. And nowadays,
what are you talking about? The Cheeto?
I'm talking about Cheetos. I'm talking about mac and cheese. I'm talking about Doritos. I mean, there's hardly a snack food out there that doesn't rely on tasty cheese powder.
You're basically describing my children's entire diet until the age of six.
We all love it. It tastes great. But it came out of the military. I mentioned that deliberately unpalatable chocolate bar. That continued to be produced for soldiers, but it ended up giving rise to the energy bar.
Wow. How about other categories of food like sliced bread or things that don't go bad, but also they're very easily and efficiently transported?
Well, slice actually, one of the interesting things is I literally got into this topic because I was making lunch for one of my kids one day and started thinking about the sandwich and the ingredients in it. Two of those ended up having a military origin in terms of their long shelf life. One was the bread, as you pointed out, and the other was the packaged deli meat. The supermarket bread actually has a bacterial enzyme in it that was researched by the military during the 1950s. It was intended to be used in canned bread. And what it does is because they swapped in a enzyme from a heat-resistant bacteria instead of the natural enzymes that come from the yeast and the wheat, that heat-resistant bacteria enzyme was able to keep functioning after the bread was baked, and it keeps it soft and moist for weeks and even months. The packaged deli meat is actually something called a restructured meat product, and that came out of a 1960s project at Natick to reduce the cost of its meat bill by 60%. And so what they did is they looked into purchasing just the cheapest cuts of meat and figuring out a way to make it look and taste like what are known as the primal cuts, you know, the steaks and the ribs, and they succeeded. Mm. And so that then became something that was used by the fast food industry.
I've kind of lost my appetite, but I think I have to ask you, what other food is the military working on and developing now?
Well, actually, there's some interesting and good news, I think, and that is they've been working on this whole set of cold sterilization techniques, which don't use cooking to both process and to preserve the food. Some of those will end up creating products that can either be stored in your refrigerator or even on your pantry shelf. They use less salt and sugar, and the products will be able to last 4 months or even a year at a time. So you'll be able to go into your closet, pull out something that looks like a TV dinner, and just warm it up in the microwave.
Well, look, Mark Bittman and Alice Waters, they are just like, their heads are spinning right now at the thought of that. So how is the push for more healthy and fresh food in the civilian sector influencing the military's R&D? Is it? And is there any kind of backlash in their thinking?
It is. It kind of goes back and forth. And one of the things, like I said, these cold preservation techniques will actually allow the military to preserve food, you know, with less of all the bad things that we don't like in them. Another way that there's sort of a back and forth are with encapsulated foods, where you put different nutrients or vitamins into the food in a teeny microscopic or even smaller capsule so that those things don't go bad or deteriorate over time.
Thank you so much for this, I think. Thanks. Yeah. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anastasia Marx de Salcedo, she's a food writer and author of Combat Ready Kitchen, How the U.S. Military Shapes the Way You Eat. Christian Bordal is here with feedback.
Hey
there, Barbara. Yes. Hi. Nice to do this little dance.
Absolutely.
With you.
Well, yesterday we talked to a student who spoke at the March for Our Lives here in LA over the weekend.
Stephen.
Caetano. And I asked listeners if they had attended any of the marches and what their experience was like, and I got some really nice responses, so I thought I'd share a couple. Ed Duffy said, my kid had to experience a lockdown scenario because of gunfire before his fifth birthday. It's absurd, the fact that we allow this to become normalized in our country. So yes, my kid and I were there, and I was proud that at such a young age, he wanted to be a part of this.
Oh, that's great. He could have that other experience to balance
exactly.
It out.
Wow. Karen Taylor says, I marched and had the most wonderful experience, met some new people. It was all very relaxed, and the atmosphere and speeches were a terrific reminder of why I love living in Los Angeles. Susan Arick said, I marched to support the kids. I didn't want to. I don't like crowds, but I'm glad I did. I was saddened by some thuggish behavior of adults attended by a swarm of cameras bullying and baiting young teenagers. It was a more tense atmosphere. But Mark Hobater says it was a wonderful experience. Lots of love filled the air. I'm proud of the young students and all the parents who brought their kids. He says feels like there's a change coming. So it seems like a lot of people really, really enjoyed the day out there.
Oh, that's really wonderful. And yeah. He was a wonderful guest, I have to say. It was just this lovely, positive spirit on the air. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, nice.
Thank you for that.
Absolutely.
And that'll wrap it up for us for today. Thank you all for listening. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.